Kildare Today with Hannah Kelly.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie.
You're very welcome into the second hour of this morning's show. Still to come between now and 11 o'clock, I'll be speaking to photographer Elle Keegan in the next few minutes as her new photography project documents the reality of life in Ireland for many people forced to move back in with older family members. We'll also be speaking to the Irish Hospice Foundation as they've released a new report that found without targeted investment and planning, Ireland is facing a potential future crisis in end-of-life care and support for people who are bereaved. Nina Carberry, Midlands North West MEP, will be joining as she has been appointed to lead negotiations on the future cap for the European Parliament's largest political group on the Budget Committee, and will be speaking to the consumer watchdog, the CCPC, as they have advice on how to avoid costly mistakes when booking a holiday this month. You can keep your messages coming in on 0833 97 97 97. I will catch up with a few of those in a minute, but just to say, as you did hear in the 10 o'clock news with Emma O'Connor, Ireland is to vote against the EU-Mercosur trade deal that has been breaking news just in the past 10 minutes or so. So the Taoiseach and Taoiseach have confirmed that Ireland will vote against the Mercosur trade agreement tomorrow. Several independent ministers and TDs within the coalition had wanted the government to continue to oppose the agreement. In a statement, Taoiseach Simon Harris said the government's position on Mercosur has always been clear in that it did not support the deal in the form in which it was presented. Now, that is breaking across all of the papers this morning, and it can also be found on the KFM radio website. Maybe we will look at that on tomorrow morning's show as well. But catching up on the messages on 0833 97 97 97, one listener has texted in saying, just to let you know, there was a three car incident on the M7 yesterday involving three trucks within an hour. A repair truck was trying to close off a lane following the second collision, and which then it was struck by another vehicle, causing further chaos for commuters. And this listener saying traffic was delayed again when the road was cleared following the crash, but about 20 minutes later, a repair truck attending the scene was struck. And this listener is saying, just, you know, the chaos that can ensue when an incident does take place on the roads. Another message comes in saying, if the government put lower tolls on the M50 and every exit toll, it would reduce traffic. A driver comes onto the M50 and Bray and travels to Lucan for free, and the M1 southbound to Blanchardstown, if everyone is using the M50 was charged, a lot wouldn't use it. And another listener has texted in regards to the quality of service from Unpussed over the Christmas. They said they think that their service was quite poor, and many Christmas cards and parcels that had been sent before the final date for postage only arrived well after Christmas. And this listener is wondering if any other listeners have experienced the same issues. And one last message this morning. This listener is wondering, can we give them a weather update for next Wednesday in the Kildare Newbridge area? I was looking on the Met Éireann website, of course, with Wednesday being 6 days away, it's only giving a very brief overview, but by the looks of it, it looks to be around 7 or 8 degrees and a bit cloudy and maybe a possible chance of rain. So that is Wednesday, the 14th of January, 7 to 8 degrees, a mixture of kind of dry spells, but a chance of rain as well. I hope that has you sorted for maybe your plans on Wednesday. You can keep your messages coming in 0833 97 97 97. Now, as I was saying, Elle Keegan is a commercial and editorial photographer, and reading a piece that she had in the Irish Times, she wrote, at 37, I find myself waking up in a 4-foot bed in my husband's childhood home, our belongings packed away in boxes and our lives suspended. When I started to document the experience in photographs, I realised that for so many of my peers, this is life in Ireland in 2026. And Elle Keegan joins me on the line now. Good morning, Elle. Welcome to the Kildare Today show, and thanks for holding there for the past few minutes. Looking at this new photography project that you did, that you're documenting for the lives of people, you wrote that it was your own experience of living in your husband's childhood bedroom that really got you started at looking at the other experience for so many people here in Ireland.
Yeah, absolutely. There's nothing more inspiring than, I guess, living through something like this. I've kind of found for a long time, like, as I've mentioned in the article, like, we went we emigrated 10 years ago because this was kind of one of the only options available to us, was to move home and save for a deposit, and we didn't have that option for ourselves. So I was aware of this, and I've seen many friends of my own or colleagues or people I've met who are in similar situations, but I feel like people, they're not having full open conversations about it because I guess maybe sometimes embarrassment or shame, or just people don't want to hear about it. So having actually lived through it, it just felt really important to actually say, well, this is actually what my experience has been like, and what's your experience been like? I want to learn more. I want to show more. I want to showcase this reality.
And for listeners, I have the article in front of me, and they're great photographs documenting and, you know, encapsulating what life is like living with older family members having to move back in. And of course, for a lot of people, they have to pack up their own lives, whether that was abroad or for somewhere else in the country, and move it into most usually a box room, essentially. For yourself, Elle, your current situation, living with your husband in his childhood bedroom, how did that all come about?
So we were in Toronto for 9 years, and essentially we'd wanted to come home for quite some time. My dad had an accident. He was quite ill, and we'd been really looking at different avenues to come home, but with two dogs, renting in Dublin wasn't really an affordable option for us. There were more options than when we left, but a lot of the pet-friendly places now are kind of luxury rentals, so we would have just completely forfeited a deposit we'd saved abroad if we wanted to rent. So it was only in August of 2024 that Colm's parents said, look, just come back and, you know, set up here and then try to get a place, because we are fortunate enough that we have been able to save. We are looking for our own permanent home, and we're in a stronger situation than most, and it's still, we're a year now in this situation trying to find a home because of shortages on the market and bidding wars and all of those things.
And reading the article, you wrote that it is no easy adjustment for anyone involved when four adults who are used to their own space come together, and especially with most of the belongings in the attic, you're at your limit in this space. In terms of the impact that this has on yourself and for many others in this photography documentation that you did, what is kind of the general consensus from people about having to live this way?
I think, like, obviously there was different experiences. Like, Roma had a much more positive experience than myself, Lynn, or Marissa and Colm. But the overall, I think, gist of it is just it's not our home, you know. Essentially, we are some level of guest in it to some extent. We don't kind of have the agency over the space that we would like, where it's kind of, and even in my own case, you're trying to always be so conscious all the time of, like, this is your home. I don't want to make that big of a footprint. Like, you know, you're kind of making sure that everyone else has their access to the kitchen, to the bathroom, to the showers, to the whatever, as much as they need. And then you're trying to schedule around that. And it's one of those things where it's like, oh, it's grand for a month, and it's grand for 2 months and 3 months. And then as 6 and 7 and 8 move by, and as life happens, and in my case, you know, with a bereavement, you're kind of trying to juggle all of these things, and you're trying to start a business again from scratch, because this will be the third time I'm starting this photography business again. And it's, you're trying to do it all, but you're doing it essentially from a bedroom, and it just gets so overwhelming. And I think that was also a very common experience, was just that, I think, sensory overwhelm that can come with having your entire life kind of just in this held breath, I guess, you know, where everything you do kind of has to be thought about to so many different levels. And, you know, everything needs a plan ahead of time. Everything needs to be considered deeply, which obviously I'm in someone else's house. I'm so grateful to have that space and to have that opportunity. And I do want to consider them. It is their space. But there are just days where you've completely been destroyed, I guess, by life and everything that comes with it, and you just need to decompress. And I find that's one of the biggest struggles, is that space to decompress.
And when it came to starting this document this the photography project. How did that come about? You said at the beginning that, you know, it's something that we are having some discussion around it, but we're not really getting really into it because there is a level of kind of embarrassment. And also it's something that I've experienced myself. Sometimes it's actually just a bit too painful to talk about, because once you get started, you feel like there's just so much negativity and feelings that come with it, that it's actually better just to kind of brush it aside and not address it. But for in your case, Elle, how did it come about to becoming this project documentary, photography project that is now printed in the Irish Times?
So honestly, it's how I kind of navigate the world myself is through photography. And so when I'm experiencing something across so many different facets of life, it's kind of like it's how I interpret and digest and move through something. So it started honestly with just a portrait of myself and Colm and Fuji and Laika, and just capturing this moment, because at the end of the day it is a unique moment in our history, in our life, and whether we want to look back on it fondly or not so fondly, it's still a moment in our lives. And it was sitting down and I was chatting with a friend of mine who is like a visual media editor. She works with the Irish Times. I worked with her many times over the years in Dublin as a photojournalist myself. And she was so encouraging and so helpful. And she basically said, look, there's more here. I really think this is a valuable story and it's worth pursuing. Like, because you know yourself, when you are working from a bedroom and you're in active grief and you're just doing your best to get by, you're kind of like, you can have these ideas, but the energy and the motivation to carry them through isn't always there. So with Laura's encouragement, I'd kind of check in with her. I'd be like, look, I've reached out to this many people and I'm getting this kind of response. And she would give me the encouragement to kind of push through then and say, look, keep going. This is an important story that needs to be told. And the more I got in touch with people, and when I put out that call, the response was so overwhelming, because I think exactly like you say, so many of us are kind of like, well, we don't want to bring it up over coffee, our one chance to get out of the house. But, you know, it is actually a huge part of our life and our experience. And so it does need to be spoken about at some point. And I think this is a great opportunity to do that.
Absolutely. And could you talk us through maybe one or the two people that you did get chatting to and that you did photograph from this story? One that I noted, you said that you began to reply to those messages. You got grown adults in their 30s, 40s and 50s happy to be photographed, but out of respect for their parents, they had to ask for their permission. It was quite a jarring, I suppose, juxtaposition of these grown adults still having to ask their parents, oh, can I tell my story?
Exactly, that's it. And it is like, and I totally understand, there's like, it's Irish culture too, I think sometimes we're afraid of upsetting people, we're afraid of being ungrateful and of all of these things. But I think the important thing is that both things can be true, that we can be grateful and we can be frustrated, that we can hold both things at the same time. And I think a lot of people in this story imagine that these people living at home are in their 20s, you know, that they came home after college. But it's honestly, it's so much more than that. There's so many of us who are 30s, 40s, 50s on, you know. This, I think, is, we're past the point where it's affecting kind of recent graduates. We're at the point where it is actually affecting every generation within Irish society. And I don't see that improving anytime soon. So I just think now more than ever, it's so important to let people know, like, this is a much bigger deal than it has been 5 years ago, 10 years ago, and it's only getting worse.
And you, in the end of the article, you say many of our lives are on hold in some way, but through the project, you hope to convey just how much life and dignity exists within these struggles. You say that we are capable, professional, intelligent, compassionate people, and this so-called failure to launch needs to be reassigned to its rightful owners. This is an amazing project that you did, and it really documents just how many people are affected by this crisis here in Ireland. Is this a series that you will continue or maybe revisit in the coming months or years?
Honestly, I would love to tell the story as long as people are willing to share it with me. So I'd say the next phase I would love is even to be able to take it to an exhibition and allow the people to actually come with me and speak on their own story. Because for me, from the very start, I said this to each person I've worked with, this is a collaboration first and foremost. I'm not looking to do this kind of story where we're all looking down and saying it's not very sad for them. I'm looking to actually convey from a point of power from each of us that says, no, we've actually done the things. We are capable people. You know, I've got my degree. My husband's an engineer. We're doing the best we can. We are walking through our phases of life and we are trying our absolute best. And there's a systemic failure that's led to this. You know, it's not a lack of motivation. It's not a lack of trying. And we deserve the dignity, you know, and we deserve to tell this story from a point of dignity, because it's just not the trope it used to be of, you know, living in your parents' basement and, you know, having that failure to launch. It's just not the same story it was before.
That is Elle Keegan, commercial and editorial photographer, on her new photography project, which documents the realism of realist lives for Ireland in for many people who are forced to move back in with older family members. And as Elle was saying, it's just about that failure to launch. People are have their careers, their degrees, and yet we are just not being given the chance to be able to move out. It's an amazing photography project that was featured in the Irish Times. I'd highly recommend picking up a copy of it and just seeing the different stories, the different people involved, all from different ages. Elle, just lastly, where can people find out more of your work? I know you're quite active on social media.
Yeah, I think Instagram at the moment is the best place to find me, at Elle Keegan, or to reach out to my website is ellekeegan.com. I have, like I said, I'm a commercial and editorial photographer, so there's a lot of food and things like that on my main site, and this is more of a passion project that I'm really taking on, so that will be the best place to get in touch.
Well, Elle, it's been great chatting to you this morning. Thanks for taking the time for our call. And again, that photography project, it can be found on the Irish Times. Elle, good morning and thank you for joining. If you are someone who is living at home, you're feeling quite stuck, you're not able to get out there and get your, you know, to be able to move out, what, no matter what age you are, we'd be interested in hearing your stories about that as well. Or if you have any parents, grandchildren or children who are in that situation where you're a house full of adults, they're all doing different jobs, and it just feels like it's quite impossible to get that option to move out, do let us know. 0833 97 97 97.
Kildare Today with Hannah Kelly.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie.
Catching up on some of the messages that have come in on 0833 97 97 97 in a response to a listener who texted asking if anyone else has been having issues in relation to on post getting Christmas cards after Christmas. One listener says, I found the postal deliveries excellent over the Christmas period. Another listener says, I could never complain about on post. I think they are on the ball. If you order online, you have it the next day. And they say they're giving it a 10 out of 10 from them. This is from Lizzie. Another message comes in saying they got a Christmas card posted on the 16th of December in America and it arrived on the 6th of January. And another listener has texted in regard to on post, their Christmas present from their brother in the UK arrived in Ireland on the 22nd of December. I received through the post a request for payment of the custom charges on the 30th and paid online the same day. A few days later, this listener had a reminder to make the payment. I've emailed them the receipt and the online tracking acknowledges that payment has been made and the package will be delivered shortly. And they are saying that the message is just reloaded. They rang on post yesterday and the recorded message say they can only see the same information that I can. How is this helpful? Come the 13th of January, it will be sent back according to the reminder to pay. So mixed messages. I mean, a lot of them are saying that they have been happy with on post. A reminder, on post did have a notably very busy Christmas period, especially in relation to the packages, because the Fastway couriers operator went into receivership back a few months before Christmas, so of course that added extra pressure on to them. But I suppose the best course of action if you are having issues with on post is to contact them directly. But you can keep your messages coming in 0833 97 97 97. Now, a report by the Irish Hospice Foundation shows that without targeted investment and planning, Ireland is facing a potential future crisis in end of life care and support for people who are bereaved. In the report, dying death and bereavement in Ireland 2026. The Irish Hospice Foundation reveals emerging trends in key areas relating to the experience of dying, death and bereavement in Ireland. The national charity highlights areas of concern and outlines actions and recommendations that will deliver improvements in key areas. Irish Hospice Foundation CEO Paula O'Reilly joins me now on the line. Good morning, Paula, and thanks for holding there as I was catching up on a few of those messages. Paula, this report found that two-thirds of people who lost a loved one indicated that the person had not been told by a medical professional that they were likely to die. What does that tell us about the communication being had for patients and their families here in Ireland?
Yeah, so as you said, thank you, Hannah, for having us on at the start of the show. We're celebrating our 40th anniversary this year, and the report was completed to really have a look at what is the current experience of dying, death and bereavement in Ireland around end-of-life care and bereavement. And as you rightly said there, one of the areas that we did identify certainly a significant gap was in relation to lack of communication at end of life. And I guess there's two aspects of it. One is where someone is, where their death is imminent and they're in the end, the last days of life. Families reported, as you said, 2 out of 3 didn't have that message communicated that someone was in their final days. And obviously for the person who has that, who is at end of life, it's really important for them to understand what's happening and also so that they can express their decisions around what's happening at end of life, and as well to make arrangements with families. So we do appreciate these are, you know, difficult conversations that require, you know, time and space, and also that people get time to think about what's been said and to go back to them. So we've definitely, one of the findings in the report is that health medical professionals aren't having those conversations. The communication isn't clear, and it's certainly one of the areas that we need to look at. Equally so is those conversations are potentially happening too late. So what we want people to consider is when you're actually well, that you consider completing your advanced care plan and thinking about what healthcare decisions, what wishes and preferences you do have if you were to become ill, because the earlier you have these conversations, it's not that it's easier, but it takes a lot of the emotion out of it, because they're very difficult conversations to have when it's at end of life.
And another finding from this report, Paula, was that the number of people dying in Ireland from a condition that will require a general and specialist palliative care is set to increase by 57% in the next year. 20 years, sorry, I should say. Considering these findings from this latest report, is Ireland's health system, are we ready for that kind of increase?
Well, I think that's why, you know, it's so important, this report, because it highlights that, you know, it is great that people are living longer, but they're also living with multiple conditions. So we're going to see a higher proportion of people that will need palliative care. And not everybody needs specialist palliative care, but people do need general palliative care that can be delivered by other healthcare professionals. So it's really important that we get investment in the new palliative care policy, but specifically around out-of-hours support and access to GPs and education and training for primary healthcare professionals. So we know from people who have shared their stories with us who are supporting people at end of life at home, because that person wants to die at home. But often what happens that out of hours, they don't have the support to manage pain. There's a panic that they don't want the person to be in any form of distress. And then they end up going in through A&E, which is reflected in the report. And then people make the decision to stay and die in hospital because they're fearful that if they are to return home, they may not get the supports they need out of hours. So I think, you know, we've made progress in many areas in terms of palliative care and end-of-life care, but I think we really need to look at investing in our out-of-hours supports, our community and primary care to make sure that all healthcare professionals can support people at end-of-life and know what that role is.
And I think a lot of listeners would relate and agree with that sentiment. There's no doubt that we, Ireland, we are one of the fastest ageing populations in the EU. And as you were saying, more needs to be done for those out of service hours, for kind of just stuff in the community to ease the pressure on the emergency departments. I suppose the question would be, is how many of the emergency visits could realistically have been avoided if there was better community and at-home supports?
Yeah, because some of those admissions, you know, it may be an acute illness and there was no planning that could have been done, you know, unfortunately for someone who may have become acutely sick. I mean, one of the areas of research that Irish Hospice Foundation are going to engage in this year is to look at what is that experience of end of life within A&E departments and look at how that can be improved. Because, you know, as I said, we can't have that due to not having support in the community that people are defaulting to A&E and then obviously being admitted into hospital. And for some people, that admission to hospital and care in hospital may be the best option because their symptoms are more complex. But at the moment, we're not clear completely in terms of what the figure is. And I think it's really important for us to look at that investment in community, but also then look at that pathway between community, A&E and our admissions and see what could be done better.
And on top of those recommendations by the Irish Hospice Foundation, another one is the impact of bereavement being formally recognised as a significant life event. I mean, anyone who has gone through bereavement or is currently going through it knows how much it can kind of upturn your life. And just the fact that work and employers still don't officially recognise it as a real thing, I suppose that's something that the Irish Hospice Foundation is calling for.
Absolutely, because, you know, when someone is bereaved, there's the psychological, the social and also the financial impact of that bereavement. And it isn't recognised as a significant life event. And yet, as you said, it is very disruptive both to the person, their families. And depending on the experience that that person has had in terms of the end of life experience of the person that they were supporting can very much impact whether that person requires more support around bereavement outside of just being their, you know, their family and their close friends. So I think there's an assumption out there that people get bereavement leave, but they don't. So I think it's really important that we identify it as a significant life event and that people do require that leave in order to be able to grieve the loss of a loved one.
And lastly, Paula, the release of this report also coincides with the Irish Hospice Foundation marking 40 years. How has the conversation around death and dying changed and what still hasn't?
As you said, we're delighted to be celebrating the 40th anniversary. And I think there has been a lot that has changed, and the report highlights some of the positive change in relation to access to hospices, education and training. But we still are very good at talking about deaths, about a death and talking about funerals and talking about death and dying in that context. But we still, both from a healthcare perspective and from a public perspective, are reluctant to talk about end-of-life care and sort of the what-if scenario. And I guess, you know, I spoke to a lady in a nursing home quite recently, and she said to me she had completed her advanced care plan, you know, and it allowed her to have control over if her health does decline, what are her wishes. But equally, she said to me she had four daughters who she's not sure whether they would all be able to come to a consensus on what would be best for her at end of life. And she wanted to take that pressure off her daughters during a very emotional time. So I think there is a need for us to normalise the discussion. And that's why the report also calls for the implementation of an advanced healthcare register, which would allow people to document their advanced care plan and then allow medical professionals to have access to it. And that would further encourage a discussion at an earlier stage.
That is Paula O'Reilly, Irish Hospice Foundation CEO, as they have released their new report that shows without targeted investment and planning, Ireland is facing a potential future crisis in end-of-life care and support for people who are bereaved. Paula, thanks so much for joining this morning, for taking our call. And as I was saying, that report coincides with 40 years of the Irish Hospice Foundation being created. That is Paula O'Reilly, CEO of the Irish Hospice Foundation. Moving over to the messages that are on 0833 97 97 97. One listener has texted in saying that there are roadworks in Clane near Alexander Bridge on the River Liffey. There are traffic jams and tailbacks on the roundabout on the direction of Salins and Naas, and traffic on the relief road. Those coming from the main street towards that roundabout and those coming from Salins and Naas direction, there are slight delays, but there is traffic lights between the roundabout and Alexander Bridge. So an update for anyone going in or out of Clane, particularly over Alexander Bridge, there are some delays because of roadworks, so just be prepared for those. Some more messages have come in about on post and kind of the experience of getting post over the Christmas. One listener from Newbridge says their friend lives in Naas and they posted a card on the 18th and they themselves got the card on the 5th of January. And another message says, I had post delivered very late and I sent cards in the time frame and they also arrived late, but I do know that they are very busy. Absolutely, there's just so much pressure on the postal services, especially around Christmas. Keep your messages coming in. 0833 97 97 97. After the break, we'll be speaking to MEP Nina Carberry as she has been appointed to lead negotiations on the future cap. And we will be speaking to the Consumer Watchdog as they are giving travel tips for people booking holidays this month.
Kildare Today with Hannah Kelly.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie.
Fine Gael MEP for Midlands North West Nina Carberry has been appointed to lead negotiations on the future Common Agricultural Policy, which is CAP 2028 to 2034. The main aims of the CAP budget are to support farmer incomes, ensure food security, protect the environment and rural development across the European Union. Ms Carberry will assume the role for the European Parliament's largest political group on the Budget Committee. And Ms Carberry joins me on the line now. Good morning and thank you for taking the call. That the CAP budget remains the largest component of the nearly €2 trillion EU fund. What do you see as the biggest priorities for Irish farmers in the next CAP cycle?
Yeah, thank you, Hannah, and good morning. I'm very honoured to be appointed negotiator of the next CAP, which is the Common Agricultural Policy, for the European Parliament's largest political party, which is the EPP group, in the Budget Committee. So we see the European Commission has come forward with proposals for the next CAP and what that would look like. So we see a real terms cut to that, which is 20% when you actually take in inflation. So we're starting negotiations off a 300 billion ring fence for direct payments. And we consider that when you look at the structure of what the CAP structure is at the minute, we see a two-pillar structure to that. So direct payments would be pillar one, and then we have a proposal alongside that, a minimum 10% rural development target. So we need a lot more clarity on that. Pillar two looks to be absorbed into other EU funds. So what we would like to see, and I know farmers would like to see, that it needs to be protected, that the two-pillar structure needs to be protected, and that we need to see an increase. So we do see a decrease in actually going forward and what the cap would look like, and to maintain full ring fencing that we currently have. So it is going to be a fight on our hands. We know there's a lot of pressure in the next 7-year budget, which is the MFF. But what I would really, really want to do in my negotiations to protect Pillar 2 and to make sure that it's a standalone, that it's not diluted or absorbed into the EU wider funding stream. And maybe to say how important actually rural development funding is, and then maybe to pick out of the Pillar 2 a funding stream that's hugely important, even for Kildare and right across the Midlands Northwest, is the leader funding. I actually was only talking to Minister Martin Hayden recently about the concerns around leader funding disappearing within Pillar 2, and that back in 2013, there was 500, half a million for each of the community centres in Castledermot, Suncroft, and Rathangan, they all secured leader funding, and that's hugely important for areas. Not just like we also need to see obviously increasing for farmers, but how important it is for rural communities. It gets literally missed in some of the debates, and how important actually Pillar 2 is for all of these areas as well, Hannah.
And how do you plan on getting started with those, with addressing those key issues and bringing them to both the parliamentary report and in consultations?
Yeah, so it basically kicks off at the beginning of this year. We're back in Brussels next week. I will be sitting with my budget committee colleagues, and we will be start forming over our own position from a parliament perspective. But I'm glad that the parliament is on board of keeping the structure of the Pillar 1 and Pillar 2 structure of the CAP. So at least we have the parliament on side, but we do have an uphill battle, obviously, to convince the council and the commission of this as well.
And I remember back in December, the Irish Farmers Association president, Francie O'Gorman, and his 11-year-old son set off on a tractor to Brussels to join the EU protest, highlighting concerns on the CAP budget as well as the Mercosur and excessive regulation. Having taken on this role of lead negotiations on the future CAP, how are you planning to engage with rural stakeholders and just the farmers here around Kildare and across Ireland in the coming months?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'd like to say, is that in the next coming weeks and months, I would love to engage directly with farmers, stakeholders to help shape the next CAP, because it's hugely important that they're at the table for this. But also, as you mentioned, Francie's son, how important the next generation is coming along, and to make them help to engage as well. It's hugely important that we have everybody involved in this going forward. The Irish presidency will be happening in the second part, and they'll be sitting and chairing the next council of the agricultural meetings as well. So Minister Martin Hayden has a huge important job ahead as well. So delighted that he's going to be at the table. Also, we have my colleagues as well from Irish MEPs and myself at the table. So I'm delighted that we have secured this position, and it's important that we keep engaging with the farming community as well.
There has been debate about ensuring food security and supporting rural economies in recent months, with multiple farmers and TDs saying that cutting the CAP budget will affect Ireland and the EU's ability to produce food. I suppose the main question is for Irish farmers here is, can they be faithful in hearing their concerns echoed in your amendments to the parliamentary report in the coming months?
Well, that's my job. I have to make sure that our voices are heard, and that's my job as an MEP, that they know the concerns from Irish farmers. And it's hugely important to secure, as you said, how important it is for food security. We know there's lots of pressure, as I said, on the next common agriculture policy. But as a whole, the budget itself, there's lots more spending being spent on defence, competitiveness, but we need to make sure that food security is right up there in priorities, and that the Commission hear us, and when we talk how important our food security is, because at the minute we don't have our food security, how are we meant to defend ourselves?
That is Nita Carberry, MEP for Fine Gael, Midlands North West, as she has been appointed to lead negotiations on the future common agricultural policy. Ms Carberry, thanks for joining us this morning. Thanks for taking our call. And that highlights, or kind of coincides now with breaking news in the past hour, that Ireland is voting against the controversial Mercosur trade deal. The ahead of the EU level vote is expected tomorrow. Cracks were emerging within the coalition, with independents in government, including Minister of State Michael Healy-Rae, stating Ireland should vote against the deal. And as you have been hearing in the news bulletins this morning, the Taoiseach and Tánaiste have both confirmed that Ireland will not be voting for the Mercosur deal. You can find out more on that on both the papers and on the KFM radio website. Keep your messages coming in, 0833 97 97 97. And another listener, in relation to Christmas cards, said that their daughter posted 5 cards in Cork on the 15th of December in the same postbox. They're all coming to family with Dublin addresses, and they all arrived on different days, and the last one arrived today. It's so strange how all of that works, but I suppose a better late than never. But of course, I mean, if you send them before the final date, you want them to get to everyone before Christmas. But keep your messages coming in, 0833 97 97 97. Now moving on to our last interview of this morning's Kildare Today show, almost one in five Irish holidaymakers experienced issues with foreign holidays between May and August of last year, with some left thousands of euro out of pocket. The Competition and Consumer Protection Commission has found that people spent almost 2,500 euro on flights and accommodation, meaning it pays to check what their rights would be in the event they run into a problem. Muriel Dolan, Deputy Director of Financial Education at the CCPC, joins me on the line. Good morning, Muriel. Thanks for taking the call this morning. The fact that people are spending 2,500 euro on average on holidays, what does that tell us about how financially exposed consumers can be when things, or if things, go wrong?
Well, 2,500 is a lot of money, and that's only the travel and accommodation. That isn't even taking into account what they're going to spend when they actually get there. And we know that 2 out of 5 people last year travelled abroad, whether it was for their summer holiday, whether it was for a concert or a sporting event. So it is quite a lot of money. And we know that about 16% of people had problems when they went abroad last year. Now, we know a lot of them from the research shows that it was flight delays or cancellations, and where there are rights there that will help people if something does go wrong. The airlines do step up and they do provide either whatever it is, whether they reroute you, whether they give you compensation. There is rules around that. But also our helpline receives queries from consumers every year on this. And last year we got over 2,500, nearly 2,700 complaints from consumers, and so many different issues. For example, one young man booked a villa for him and his friends, and he paid by bank transfer. And unfortunately, it was a scam. And it's very difficult, almost impossible, to get your money back if you pay by bank transfer. And that's one of our messages to your listeners this morning, that if you are going to pay, try and use a debit or credit card, because if something does go wrong, you have a better chance of getting your money back.
Mm. And travel insurance is also another thing urged by the CCPC as a way of easing, you know, problems like these. But findings from this report show that 30% of holiday makers travelled uninsured, rising to 48% among those under 35. It looks like in particular, young people are opting out of travel insurance. Is it a mindset of just trying to save as much money as possible?
I think it is, and some people feel they don't need it, because we did ask that to the participants. Some people said they didn't need it, some people said they forgot about it, other people said they couldn't afford it, it was just too much on top of the holiday. But actually, if you look at how, on average, how much people are spending, which is 2,500, it's a lot of money, and you can get reasonably good value when you shop around on travel insurance. And what we would say to your listeners, if you are going to get travel insurance, shop around, but if you book your holiday today, buy your insurance today, because it will cover you if anything happened between now and your holiday. So for example, if you got sick or your family member got sick and you couldn't travel, then you can claim on your travel insurance if you've paid for flights. Also, it's important to look, if you're going to travel more than once during the year, maybe look a multi-trip insurance, because it'll be cheaper in the long run than getting single trip insurance. And also, if you've any pre-existing conditions, make sure that you tell that to the insurance company, because if something happens and you haven't disclosed that information to the insurance company, they won't cover you.
It seems that, and especially with January being peak season for people booking holidays, it's just ensuring that you get your insurance before buying the holiday, and as well just to watch out for those scams and to never pay by bank transfer. Muriel, where can people find out more travel tips and information on their rights as holiday makers?
Yeah, we have a lot of information on our website, ccpc.ie. So there's a lot of information there. And we know that there's a lot of people advertising holidays at the moment. So just be very careful when you go online. Make sure that you're on a reputable website. If it's an advert, don't click into it. Get the name of the company and do your own Google search and go in and look and see, is the offer there. And also look at independent websites like TripAdvisor, Trustpilot, Reddit, to see what people are saying about these travel companies or these travel destinations before you book.
That is Muriel Dolan, Deputy Director of Financial Education at the CCPC, as they have found that almost one in five Irish holidaymakers experienced issues with foreign holidays last year, with some left thousands of euro out of pocket. Muriel, good morning, and thanks for taking our call this morning. I know January is a very busy month for people booking holidays, kind of to get over those post-Christmas and January blues. If you are booking a holiday this month, just be mindful of those travel tips. You can find out more information and tips on the ccpc.ie website.